Hello, this is Wilton Vaught. Welcome to Episode 1 of Nonviolent Direct Action, featuring Jack Gilroy of Veterans for Peace interviewing Claire Grady. On April 4, 2018, Claire and six other Catholic Plowshares activists entered Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in St. Mary's, Georgia. Kings Bay is the largest nuclear submarine base in the world, serving as the base for six ballistic missile subs and two guided missile subs. The activists went to three sites on the base, the SWFLANT Administration Building, the D-5 Missile Monument Installation, and the nuclear weapons storage bunkers. The activists used crime scene tape and hammers and hung banners, one of which read, "The ultimate logic of Trident is omnicide." They also brought an indictment charging the U.S. government with crimes against peace. Their website is kingsbayplowshare7.org. And now, Jack Gilroy interviewing Claire Grady.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jack Gilroy, and I'm president of Chapter 90, Stu Naismith Chapter of the Veterans for Peace in Binghamton, New York. Just a word about Stu. Stu was a 17-year-old when he went into the U.S. military in World War II. Couldn't understand why the Quaker people that he lived with didn't believe in killing. Then he went to the South Pacific, saw awful things, including Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He came home in late 1945, and he became a Quaker. So we're really credited with starting our local group back before the shock and awe of 2003. And we've done a lot of active things over the years. And the very positive effect, too, has been that the National Veterans for Peace Organization has been very firm in its condemnation of nuclear weapons and the potential for accident or intentional use of nuclear weapons, and especially the so-called first strike option of the United States. The working group of the Veterans for Peace, in fact, has called for greater education of Americans on nuclear weapons, which we don't find in the general media. Here is basically what they said. Educate other Veterans for Peace members in our communities through position statements, press releases and other publications, lectures, vigils, marches, and other public events, tabling and direct actions at home and abroad. I'll let Claire tell you what resistance is. I'll let Claire tell you what direct action is, because she has an ankle brace, and the ankle brace has very strong significance. And I think it's up to you to for Claire to tell you why she is now under house arrest. So Claire Grady, a great American resister, a person who we absolutely appreciate, who has put herself online and is facing potentially years in prison for an act that is an act for all of us. Claire, thank you very much.
Thanks for doing this interview, Jack. And it was good to hear about your chapter of Veterans for Peace. And I think of Stu Naismith with gratitude and fondness.
A lot of people recognize the name Naismith. They may not be aware that Stu's grandfather invented the most famous, most popular game in the world today, the game of basketball. He was a Presbyterian minister in Massachusetts at a YMCA when he had one of his kids go and get a peach basket out in the hallway and then tack it up to a runway around the YMCA and then said, "Get a measuring tape and see how high that is." And that is the height that it's still at today.
I never heard this story.
10 feet.
Oh, my
Stu
goodness.
Used to tell it when our Veterans for Peace group with Stu, myself, and George Hassler and George McAnanima from New York City, when we travel around the schools. And that was one way you could always get the hook to get the attention of the students. How many people in here know who James Naismith is? And there'd almost always be one or two of the students who would right away
basketball
say the founder
lovers.
Of basketball. So that's our hook here for people in one sense. But the biggest hook is to have the pleasure today, Claire, of you being here with us and telling us. Tell us right off, why do you have that ankle bracelet on?
So I'm currently out on bail, pretrial bail, I, together with my six co-defendants, was arrested at Kings Bay Naval Base in southeast Georgia, the largest naval base of Tridents in the world. The submarine that carries the missile, the DE-2 missile, that weapon system is the deadliest weapon system in the world today. And Kings Bay, Georgia, is the home of six of those Trident submarines that carry that that weapon, and also is port to four from Great Britain as well. Anyway, this beautiful, beautiful place on Earth is the home to some of the most deadly, deadly weapons in the world.
And when you say omnicide, that they're capable of omnicide, could you explain what you mean by that?
So it's some people have never heard that word before, and as I understand it, the word means the death of all living. So the death of the planet as we know it would happen if these weapons are used, and they're designed and intended to be used in a first strike way. One thing that's really important for me in talking about these weapons is that they're not just a danger if they're used with where we experience that chain reaction from their explosion with radioactivity covering the Earth, but they're deadly every day just by their mere existence. So it feels really important to say that the mining of the uranium used to make these is all done on indigenous land. The testing for these weapons is done on indigenous land, and the dumping and the storage of the radioactive material is mostly done on indigenous land. And so indigenous people have been organizing for decades to resist this. And I kind of explain it as indigenous people here on Turtle Island have experienced the deadly force of imperial power and waste from the beginning of
So what did you do to resist it then? What was your act of resistance?
Yeah, I actually want to say two more things about the deadly nature of those weapons. Their explosive power, their mere existence that takes the lives of indigenous people and the health of the planet, the money that's stolen to build and maintain these weapons, and then the way these weapons are used as the biggest bully stick in the planet. If you have the biggest weapon on the planet and the most military bases on the planet, basically you get to call the shots. So when we went to Kings Bay, Georgia in April, we talked about the triplets that were identified by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and triplets of racism, militarism, and extreme materialism. Basically, that weapon, the Trident, enforces those triplets, on down to, I believe, the police gun that's used on the streets of our cities and the jails that house the people in another form of enslavement. So that feels, I'm putting my life out there in Kings Bay to say all of that and not truncate it, not shorten it, not gloss over it. I feel really strongly that we are here to reveal the nature of those weapons, and not just as a scientific matter of explosion, but how they participate in maintaining and forcing systems that kill every day. That's why I put my life there, and that's why I need to say that very clearly over and over again.
So can you tell us what you and the other six did to deserve the punishment of the United States government for saying you are opposed to killing?
So we went, there were seven of us. Liz is the oldest. She's a 78-year-old woman, Liz McAllister, and she's one of the founders of Jonah House, longtime beloved sister in the community working for faith-based resistance. And Steve Kelly, a Jesuit priest who's been doing Plowshares Actions for decades now. And Patrick O'Neill from North Carolina, Catholic Worker. And Mark Colville from the Amistad Catholic Worker in New Haven. Carmen Trotta, from New York Catholic Worker, Martha Hennessy, granddaughter of Dorothy Day, and myself, we all went just simply getting in across a gate. We cut a lock and went through a fence and walked under the stars up to the area where the bunkers are that house these missiles for this omnicidal weapon.
Can I interrupt you for a minute?
Yeah.
Here is one of the most dangerous, most destructive systems in the whole world. And you're telling us you went and you just clipped the lock and walked in?
So the area where the missiles are kept has three fences, and it's a deadly force zone, and they have guards watching at all times with orders to shoot to kill. So three of us went there. Liz McAllister, Steve Kelly, and Carmen Trotta cut the fence to get into that area. They were met right away with the big guns and a lot of force. Thankfully, they were not killed. And repeatedly with these plowshares disarmament actions, when guards see the demeanor of the people who are clearly not trying to hide, and they're carrying a banner, and their posture is nonviolent, that they don't shoot to kill them. So they weren't killed, but they were treated roughly. And the rest of the four of us, Martha Hennessy and I, and Mark Colville and Patrick O'Neill, we went to another place that was maybe 15 minutes away, walking. Patrick and Mark chose to hammer on the missile monuments that are there at Kings Bay. There are about six or seven or so very big monuments of these deadly missiles. And so they plied off the words of the sign and poured blood on the symbol there for the Navy for this weapon system, and hammered and put up banners on these monuments. Martha and I went over to a building right near that missile where it's the administrative office of Swift Atlantic. So basically it's administrative offices for the weapons system. And we put up crime scene tape. We put up an indictment on the door, and we spray painted disarm trident, love one another. And we left a copy of Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine. Book about it by a nuclear weapons planner, right? So this is a first-hand account by a man who was...
Daniel Ellsberg, the man who did the
Pentagon
papers, right?
So we left a copy of his book there, and we poured a small amount of our blood on the ground, all to reveal the bloody, deadly nature of these weapon systems. And Martha and I went over to where Patrick and Mark were and waited there for the guards on the base to see us, and we were arrested. We took responsibility like we always do in these situations. We take responsibility for what we do. We don't think what we do is criminal. We think we are upholding the best of our laws that basically say it is illegal and criminal not only to blow up the world, but to threaten to blow up the world and to steal our resources to threaten to blow up the world, to maintain such weapons and such an aggressive posture. So
this is not civil disobedience, it's resistance.
Well, what I call it is, resistance, faith-based resistance. And basically, the way I see it is that laws change with human consciousness evolving. So it's not, it's a probably a helpful example that right there in Georgia, 150 years ago, 160 years ago, it was considered legal and normal at the time to enslave human beings and consider them three-fifths human. That was the law at the time. That law has changed. It's evolved as human beings have evolved with their consciousness. So, and with a lot of struggle. So what I see is that in the last 100 years, on the heels of such awful wars, World War I and World War II, that the human family, nations, got together and decided that it's not okay to use weapons of mass destruction that don't discriminate between civilians and combatants. It's not okay to use weapons that destroy and poison the water or the air or the land. It's illegal to do all of those things. And then after World War II, we got even more evolved and we said, it is not okay to allow your government to commit genocide in Germany, for instance, in your name without doing something. You can't just say, I was just minding my own business or taking orders and carrying out orders that were given to me. That there's some responsibility when something's being done in your name to take responsibility to stop it when it's a crime.
So would you be able to use that Nuremberg result in your trial?
I don't know, but what I want to say very significantly, Jack, we're going to try. We're going to try. But what's really important to any viewers or listeners here is that disarmament is an unenforceable thing. I'm part of a 12-step program called Al-Anon. 12-step programs, they talk about them as the unenforceable. You either do recovery or you don't. Nobody gets to force you. And your higher power never forces you, invites you at every turn. There's consequences when you don't do the will of your higher power, and they're harmful and painful, but no one is forced. So with nuclear weapon disarmament, we have now this incredible treaty that was signed by 122 countries last July, and it calls for the abolition of nuclear weapons. No one is forced to sign that treaty, and even if you do sign that treaty, no one can force others to sign that treaty. So you either disarm or you don't. And so we in the United States lead the way in nuclear weapons and all deadly force and all incarceration force. You know, we lead the way in colonization at this moment, right? In collective thing. So our action, and I invite others to consider this, is withdrawing consent from that system, my participation in the system that's killing right now every day. And so that is not forcing someone else to do it. That's doing it myself and being invitational. So all those laws that are on the book that we talked about, you know, the crimes against the peace and Nuremberg and all that, unless you actually uphold it, it's meaningless, right? It can't be forced, and it doesn't mean anything if no one's living it. So my sense in this faith-based disarmament work is that you actually do the disarmament. And it's symbolic in that you're not pretending that you have the ability or the muscle or the intelligence to get rid of all the weapons in the world yourself. That's not your job. Your job is to do one little part. And as we see with this ankle bracelet and how the government has responded, we're touching a nerve when we simply expose the deadly nature of these weapons. Exposing it it's sort of like the work of not being in denial, right? As soon as we say, this is the true nature of our disease, it's sort of like this blowback happens. It's like diabolic, actually. And so we see that the government charged us with four very significant charges, federal conspiracy and destruction of government property and depredation and trespass, all totaling to 25 years. So we'll go to trial facing these charges that hold considerable amount of time. We have been promised that the government will try to keep us from talking about the weapon. They will forbid us to talk to the jury of our peers about the Trident. They will forbid us to talk about the crime that this weapon is and the laws that illustrate that. They will forbid us from talking about the Constitution that talks about these treaties and laws being the supreme laws of our land. They will forbid us from talking about our conscience, about God, about the biblical call to beat swords into plowshares, even though it is the Bible Belt, indeed, where that trident is. So we know that they have done that kind of silencing before, and they don't want that weapon to be exposed, and they don't want people to be empowered to do their part in disarming it or withdrawing consent from its existence.
Can we talk a little bit more about that? When you bring up the Bible Belt, I think we're all well aware of the fact that the majority of people in this country claim to be Christian. You acted with the groups called the Catholic Workers and Plowshare Action. What is the position, as you understand it, of the Catholic? You are a Catholic. What is the position of the Catholic Church and maybe other Christian churches as well in reference to nuclear weapons?
So Pope Francis recently said it's a sin to even possess them. It would be very helpful if people magnified that word from Pope Francis, and if we could hear that in our local parishes. But yes, I'd like to say that loud and clear. The Catholic Church has a lot to say about killing.
But, you know, they can make these statements, and the bishops can make, you know, these proclamations. Do you think it gets down to the pulpit, to the average Catholic Christian? And on top of that, what about the Baptist ministers and the Methodists and the Presbyterians, all part of the Christian scheme of things?
Well, Jack, I am Catholic, and I've been attending Mass at Immaculate Conception here in Ithaca for many years, since my kids were babies. Over the years, I have found it very difficult watching my mother, when she was alive, plead for some church teaching to be taught in the church, in the local parish church. I remember when she asked if they could teach on Pacem in Terris, which is a papal encyclical on peace on earth, right? Mm-hmm. And she was told that there's no space for that here. You have to do that somewhere else, right? That's what they said to her. I promised myself that I wouldn't spend my life beating my head against the wall with that kind of relationship. So I chose to simply say thank you whenever anything positive was said from the pulpit. But then I realized I was committing a sin of omission, I think, by not saying anything. The last time my mother and I went to an event at the church on War and Peace, about maybe 8 months before my mother died, we were going to Mass. My mother loved Mass, and I loved going to Mass. And it was announced during the midday Mass that there would be a session downstairs. They were going to talk about the fifth the commandment, thou shalt not kill. And they were giving 5 or 6 weeks of attention to that commandment. And one of those many weeks was going to be about war. So we went down for the hour session that was presented by the paid staff person by the church to teach about war out of all the things on thou shalt not kill. And so this fellow who we paid to teach us church teaching said, he only chose to speak about the just war theory. He didn't talk about Pacem in Terris. He didn't talk about the gospel. He didn't talk about Jesus. He didn't talk about what the popes say. He didn't talk about anything but the just war theory. And then he said, strikingly so, you should never actually apply the just war theory, because if you were to find any service people that were guilty of not being in compliance, then that would sort of hurt them. They would be not in good standing with the church, so you should actually not use it. And he repeated that about 3 or 4 times, and I found it troubling that not only the priest didn't object to that, but none of my fellow 20 parishioners thought that there was a problem in that, that the one time out of many years that we're talking about war, that we're only talking about just war, none of the other rich stuff of the church, and that we're told actually don't even apply it. So, and I asked if I could speak to them about it, and it was a very unwelcoming place to talk about that. Well, different priests change and so on, and there's another priest there now that is wonderful, Father Chumo, but I'm not there right now. I'm mostly in South Georgia. I'm out on bail, so I am one of 7 co-defendants, and when we were first arrested, we were put in jail in Camden County, South Georgia, an especially archaic jail where you didn't see, you could go weeks and not see the light of day. We're supposed to get an hour a week to get outside to the little tiny courtyard.
An hour a day, supposedly, according to the law.
Well, according to the law, but according to them, an hour a week, and you were lucky if you got that hour a week. You were lucky. And so we were starved for light, and we were starved for space and good food, but we had such amazing community there in that cell block in Camden. But in that place, we were not given bail. We were on state charges, and we were being held with no bail. When the federal government indicted us, 5 weeks later, we were brought to another jail in Glynn County, Brunswick, Georgia, is in Glynn County. So from there, we were held on $50,000 bail, and we some of us, well, three of the seven of us got out right away there in mid-May at our bail hearing, and Steve Kelly cannot get out on bail. Liz McAllister and Mark Colville chose to stay in, and I just got out last week. Was hoping to reduce this $5,000 cash and $50,000 surety and a home arrest with an ankle bracelet because I felt it was improper. And so, you know, the point of bail is to ensure that you come back to trial and also that you're not a danger to the community. Well, I explained to the judge, I'm going to be 60 years old this year. I've been doing this since my 20s. 40 years of my record show that I always show up for court, for trial when I have a trial, and that I never risk arrest before trial. So the use of this, and that I'm innocent until proven guilty, like you're assuming that what I did is a crime. I'm saying that what I did was upholding the law. And so there's a difference of perspective, but I can say from my point of view, it certainly seems very punitive that I'm being held on home arrest. I cannot walk outside of my door except to reach to the mailbox, but I can't hang up my laundry or water the plants or greet my neighbors outside that door. Unless I have explicit permission from my probation officer, a very nice man from Syracuse, who came down to set up the equipment in the house here and put this on my leg. And I plug it in every night for about a half an hour or an hour to recharge this global positioning device. I'll be charged $100 or so a month to imprison myself.
You're listening to Episode 1 of Nonviolent Direct Action, featuring Jack Gilroy of Veterans for Peace, interviewing Claire Grady, one of the seven Kings Bay Plowshares activists who on April 4th, 2018, entered Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in St. Mary's, Georgia.
Steve Kelly, you said he cannot because he has other charges pending, or why can't Steve?
He has a charge pending from the West Coast where he did a peaceful blockade at another weapons. Yeah, the other Trident, U.S. Trident base is on the West Coast, and Steve has been part of disarming at that coast, at that base in Tacoma, Washington.
It seems, if I can digress just a little bit, but it's related, that you came into my classroom some 30 or so years ago with Peter DeMott, your brother-in-law, where Peter, were you involved in that action? Was Peter actually that was involved in an action at New London, Connecticut?
Sister Ellen and my brother John were both part of that action with Peter in Groton, Connecticut, they hammered on the Trident weapon system
back in 1982. That was an amazing story. My ninth grade students had eyes as big as saucers when they heard Peter talk about how he commandeered the vehicle to go down.
Well, that was another action before the
one. Well, was it?
That was before the Trident, Plowshares number 4. That was Peter who... Yes, you could tell.
Quite a history.
Story.
Yeah, you have quite a history. Well, anyway, Peter told how when he started ramming the sub with the vehicle, that the shore patrol had to jump up on the hood and beat the windows, break the windows in to pull Peter DeMott out. But back to this idea of the action itself in Georgia. Now, can you tell us a little bit about how you got along with some of the people? Were you able to be with some of the other inmates there other than your own group of Catholic workers?
When we first we were brought to Camden County, we came into the cell block. It was just about count time, 11 p.m. count time and lock-in. And we were greeted with great hospitality the first night. And the next day, everyone came around us. And the first thing they said was, they asked us what we had done. They'd heard a little bit about it, and they said, "Gangster grannies." So calling us gangster grannies.
Yeah.
And we were warmly, warmly welcomed in that cell block in Camden County. And
multiracial?
Yeah, yeah. Perhaps more white people, women than black women.
Yeah.
Definitely in Camden County. Not so in Glynn County. Yeah, we were together very closely. We shared meals and prayers and games. And you were talking earlier about basketball, and I was thinking about this wonderful thing that we experienced in Camden County. On the chance that we got to go to the little rec area that 1 hour a week, the women would take two socks and roll them up and make a ball, and they called it a volleyball. And we would pretend that we had a volleyball net. There was no net, but... Yeah. And we would play volleyball for that whole hour.
Yeah.
And we would laugh our asses off for an hour.
Yeah.
It was so much joy with this game. Well, called it sock volleyball. So this outside rec time would happen on Monday. Well, 1 week, the Monday had a rainstorm or something happened, so we weren't able to go out. And the very kind guard thought she would give us about a half an hour on a Friday. I think it was a Friday. And it turns out that the deputy sheriff normally would be on court on Monday, so wasn't present for when the women were having their rec. But this day he was there, and he heard our laughter, and he came into the rec area, this tiny little rec area, and he took the sock ball away and said, "You will not be playing this game again." And he said, "Do you know why?" And you were silly if you ever ventured an answer to his questions, because it was always going to be a long lecture about why you were wrong and stupid. So he said, "Do you see that area up there on the wall? That used to have a basketball hoop, and that's not there anymore, because that basketball hoop was the occasion for people fighting, and we can't have that. And somebody could get hurt." And I thought, I wonder if the entire prison, vast prison system of the United States, over 2 million of us imprisoned people in the United States, have gotten the memo about no doing anything where there might be a fight or risk, you know, no basketball. But my experience was that anything where there was palpable joy, that it was stopped. And this was in Glynn County as well.
Did you weren't looking necessarily for converts, but did some of those people, and I suspect many of them poor whites and poor blacks, did they come to understand your position? Did they understand the concept of conscience leading you to do what you did?
Oh, yeah. They understood that right away, and they understood, they didn't know all about the weapon, but once they heard that the trident was there and that it was this deadly weapon, they had no trouble. Many of the white women had relatives who worked on the base and worked, some of them, on that weapon, were commanders of the Trident submarine.
Mm-hmm.
And those, most every woman in that cell block in Camden County was dealing, not all, but most, were dealing with drug addiction. And so it was so interesting to me to think of, they were considered the black sheep of the family with a drug addiction, but then the other family members who had the job on the base that made quite a bit of money had perhaps a different part of the addiction, you know, that was seen in as normal and kind of certainly get paid well, and but it was kind of looked up to. And so they kind of understood the hypocrisy of some of these things. They understood that already. They also understood that you have to take a stand. And there would be these lectures that would happen in the cell block. The deputy sheriff would come in if somebody had a fight or something, and or something was found, and contraband or something. We'd get a long lecture, and And this one time they said, and no one is to touch each other. Now, it's pretty common in the North here that every jail and prison I've been in, you're not allowed to touch, you're not allowed to hug. But I was struck by their ability to, at least the practice of hugging each other, of doing each other's hair, of praying together. Mm-hmm. So this night, after we got a very firm lecture about no touching, the women held their usual prayer meeting that would be 20 minutes before lock-in at 20 before 11 p.m. And they would say, prayer circle, prayer circle. And so I would try to stay up for this because I wanted to reciprocate such a fine offer, right, and participate. And so I show up, and then Liz and Martha, who are both early to bed people, they rose up and they came, and we're all standing around. And I noticed that Liz and Martha and I, as much as we're practicing non-compliance with a system of oppression and death, we stood with our arms down, not willing to touch anyone. And the other women in the circle said, what do you mean? Of course we're going to hug. Yeah. And they put their arms around us, and right in front of the camera for the cell block, there we all were with our arms around each other's necks, like 16 women doing the nightly prayer circle, right? Yeah. So they were very, she said, we don't follow all those rules. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
So they were certainly our teachers on many things, and they understood us, and we hoped to understand them. We loved each other. There were tears, a lot of tears when they took us out of there.
Could I get back for a minute with you on this whole business of Christianity and the reaction to it? Were there priests or ministers who visited you frequently there? Could you tell us about any of that and what their attitude was?
Thankfully in Camden County, there were ministers that came in, Christian ministers from different Baptist church and so on, that came in faithfully and ministered to the women. And the women were grateful and devoted to that time. And it happened on a weekly basis, once or twice a week. They felt loved, cared for, and guided because they were looking for that guidance of how to put their hands into something greater than like this drug addiction, which most people felt ravaged by. So I wanted to give some background. I remember going to one of the Christian circles, and also just to say, I look forward to that kind of thing. Even though I may not be Baptist, I glean a lot from anybody's offering, right? Even if you're agnostic, I want to listen to you and share some uplift. I guess that goes without saying, but down there it may need to be said. So here I am in this session. Martha and I both attend. Two women come from a local Baptist church, and there are probably about 16 of us jail prisoners and who are attending. And the two women that came to speak with us were basically giving testimony and sharing a little bit of Bible verses. And at one point, one of these women said, and that those people that went to Kings Bay, that was just bad. That was against God's will. So I wasn't going to go for the bait, but my co-defendant and friend Martha Hennessy said, she raised her hand and she said, I am one of those people that went to Kings Bay, and I don't think that it was against God's will. And then a conversation ensued, and the woman was saying, the Bible would prohibit that, and the Bible, they point to Romans 13, says, obey authority and you should never break the law. Never break the law. So I was not going to say anything for a long time, but then I finally raised my hand and asked, could I speak? And I said, she said, yes. I said, you know, thank you for coming, and I'm really grateful for this conversation. I am from New York State. I came here to disarm the Trident, but where I live a half an hour from the home of Harriet Tubman. I said, I'm quite sure Harriet Tubman broke the law again and again and again. And the woman said to me, well, she did it to save people from harm. I said, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. If depends on who you would have asked at the time, whether they would say that's what she was doing or not. If you had asked one of the plantation owners that had actually enslaved human beings, they might have something else to say about that. So I think we should actually ask the people on the receiving end of the harm if there's harm being done.
Right.
Right? So it's not for me to say that there's no harm. If it, you know, I'm feeling the harm. But anyway, I then gave example after example in the Bible, starting with the midwives that didn't follow Pharaoh's orders when they spared Moses' life and put him in the basket and put him in the reeds, and there he was. He became just like Harriet, the one to lead people out of enslavement. And then going on with the three kings, that they didn't obey Herod and they went a different way and they didn't tell where the baby was, and that Jesus was walking through the standing grain and he didn't ask permission. He just took some of that grain and ate it because they were hungry. I could go on and on and on. And I did give some more examples. And it was so interesting. The women that were present who really had this loving relationship with the women. And in the South, there's this code of respecting elders, and these women were older. They always called miss or sir and deferred to elders with a lot of respect. And right from behind me, I could hear Mo raise her hand. She started speaking. She said, "Well, Miss so-and-so, I think it's really important that we not criticize people for what they're in here for, that we kind of respect each other and not criticize people for what you think is a crime." Or anyway, I didn't expect that at all. But literally, and later back in the cell block, I said, "I hope we weren't disrespectful." And they said, "Not at all. We had tears in our eyes as you were speaking, and we thought it was great what you were saying."
What you were doing was in prison ministry, I guess, right? And you sort of took a page from the minister who was in doing the preaching. And that's a great story. That's really interesting. Again, on another issue, since you are a Catholic, were there Catholic priests or bishops that came to see you?
So we had no bishops. There is a Catholic priest in Waycross, Georgia. So that's about 40-minute drive from St. Mary's, and he would come as often as he could to see us and bring us Eucharist and pray with us. Mm-hmm. His name is Father Bob Cushing. We were so grateful for his presence there. The Catholic priest at the church, the Star of the Sea Church in St. Mary's, is a young man from Poland, and we were glad to make his acquaintance. We had to ask him to come. He was not at all ministering to any of the Catholic women. The few Catholic women that were there were ready to be baptized Baptist because they didn't have any Catholic ministers. So we were glad to tell him what we experienced in the jail there, and also glad to tell him about nuclear weapons and United States. He's not from the United States. He's Catholic from Poland. And I thought he was actually, well, he didn't come to that, to our meeting from a position of understanding nuclear weapons. He was open to listening, and he also wanted to be heard about what he felt like as someone from Europe who lived under the threat of Soviet weapons.
Do you know Father Bob coming, why he is just 40 miles away from there? Why? Do you know the story? I met him in Austria 10 years ago.
If you want to tell that story.
Yeah, I tell it very quickly, that he had a big parish near Atlanta, and he took his parishioners to Hiroshima. And in Hiroshima, he apologized for the nuclear destruction, the incineration of the people. And he was criticized, admonished by his bishop. And that's why he's 40 miles away in a small rural area today. He was banished for his belief that people should say we're sorry for what we did in this horrible killing. So, yeah, I think it's such a focus, this whole business of Christianity. Like 100 years ago, the Catholic bishops formed what became known as their own organization, but calling it the Catholic War Council. And it was that today is the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. Thankfully, there seems to be an evolution, not necessarily in saying no, that they still believe in just war. They still follow the just war philosophy. But there is an evolution there, and people like you, Claire, and the other six members that you're speaking of could surely say a lot. The names that she's dropping here, for example, Martha Hennessy, is the granddaughter of that saint, really, not yet a saint, but probably someday will be, Dorothy Day, one of the great American radicals, right, a Catholic radical. And, of course, Liz McAllister was the wife of Phil Berrigan, who spent probably 10 years in prison for his activities in opposition to nuclear weapons. I was with Liz at the Pentagon before the Pentagon became super secure, and we had a die-in. This was for the School of the Americas Watch, which has its roots in Georgia, right? And people lie down. There were probably 50 or 60 people. It was April. It was really very, very cool and rainy. But they nevertheless, they lied down, and then the marshals came along with big hoses because the people had some blood, fake blood spread on them, and they started hitting the individuals with the water. Your friend Liz McAllister, right? Liz didn't get out yet. She's still in Georgia, right? Liz tapped one of the marshals on the shoulder, and she said, "Excuse me, now, if that was gas, killing gas, would you do what you're doing?" And he turned, he said, "I follow orders, ma'am. I'm just following orders." I think it says an awful lot about our culture, our history, you know, and where we're at.
Yeah.
Tell us about what you think what's going to unfold now in coming months, Claire.
Yes. So the seven of us are scheduled for pretrial motions hearings on August 2nd. So the four of us who are out on home arrest with ankle bracelets, we each of us will be traveling down to South Georgia again. And each leg of the journey, we have to get permission. We have to have an address and the time we arrive, and I have to bring my apparatus with me to South Georgia so that I can be monitored the entire time. So we will be there hearing motions, arguing motions. We put in motions to dismiss on substantive grounds that these weapons are illegal, and that, well, actually...
Who is your lawyer?
So we have many lawyers helping us. We like to work as a team. Some of us going pro se with co-counsel or standby counsel. But some of the lawyers are Bill Quigley from the Southern Poverty Law Center, who's been working in New Orleans for years as a people's lawyer. Anna Lelid, who works also in New Orleans as a remarkable lawyer from there, working with the people. A lawyer from Brunswick, Georgia, named Jason Clark, whose father was a well-known and well-loved lawyer working on death penalty cases in Georgia. So I imagine he was very busy. Jason Clark and his wife, Susan, they didn't know us before, but they read about us in the paper, and they reached out to us and said they'd like to help pro bono. Right. I discovered the day that I got out and was being brought to to catch my plane, we passed by the office of Jason and Susan, Jason Clark and his wife, and there it was, right on downtown, right near the neighborhood where people would most likely need to get a lawyer, and most of the women in the cell block or the pod in Glynn County knew Jason Clark, not just as a really good lawyer who would always get you off, would always help you, mm-hmm. but that he was personable. Women would automatically offer these stories about how his wife and he would say, "Where's your baby?" or "Where's your mm-hmm. grandbaby?" or, you know, like he was mm-hmm. a community member. Yeah. A loving, compassionate man. So we're super lucky to have such a compassionate and bright team. We also have a lawyer named Stephanie McDonald. She hails from South Dakota originally, and she's been practicing in the federal system for 4 or 5 years in Georgia. She's very bright, and she gets the bigger picture, and she's willing to work with the team of lawyers and is... very accessible, which makes the law accessible, which is my big point.
You don't know what actually is going to happen at this August 2nd event, but Claire, do you have some sort of indication or expectation or hope of what might occur when you go to Georgia for this next meeting with the legal
folks? What we do know what it's for, and we do know that the government has been trying to, for decades now with these cases of disarmament, tried to prohibit the mention of the weapons. So we're expecting them to go forward like that again here, but I don't know exactly how they're going to do that, and we'll see when we get there.
Okay.
I do encourage people, I think that our father, John Peter Grady, would say, being in a courtroom, you will get one of your best educations that you can get. You will see sort of how the system works. Who goes to jail, who doesn't go to jail. What they go to jail for, what they don't go to jail for. What the what truth is allowed and what truth is not allowed. So I encourage everyone, just even just locally, to go down to their courthouse, and that's a public space. Who's going to jail in our community and who's not going to jail and for what? And so also in this case, please welcome if you're in Georgia to come there, or if you want to take a trip to Georgia. It's pretty far, but we're certainly inviting people to come to trial. We think it's going to be in the beginning of December.
The media isn't paying much attention to this. And, you know, why is that? Why are we in a culture with so much apathy in the face of such horrendous danger?
I think people are overwhelmed with just the day-to-day, and that some people are not apathetic. A lot of people are active on their own behalf and their children's behalf just to stay alive, right? Here in our community in Ithaca and around Turtle Island and around the world. I think people are very active. The media is another question. The media, corporate media, has definitely got an interest in keeping the system going. So they're not going to tell you the truth about these weapons or any of the deadly force that's pointed at them. They're just not going to tell you. They're not going to connect the dots. So for me, I feel particularly as a white woman of privilege in this system, in North America, United States of America, I feel particularly responsible for that first strike, first world weapon that's been paid for and kept and used in my name. I don't feel that disarming that weapon is the business of my neighbor here who's got family in a prison or just trying to get food on the table or childcare. And so people, I think, people are not stupid. They're doing what they need to do to keep going every day. We have to be careful about what media we're listening to and who's calling the shots. And my experience is like, corporate media, if I tune into it, I will learn very quickly who they want me to hate and who they want me to kill, or who they want me to be quiet about while they kill them, something like that. What they want me to buy, who they want me to make rich, or who's stealing the public funds. I think people are active, and I think people are overwhelmed just basically with survival. And I think it's a great service to simply connect the dots of how our struggles are connected. And I brought, I want to uplift the names and the work of some of the people, indigenous people, who've been doing organizing for a very long time. And one is a woman that lives right here in New York, in Buffalo. She's a Seneca woman in Seneca territory. Her name is Agnes Williams, and she has come to Ithaca. She's been interviewed on the Ithaca Radio some years back because of her work in anti-nuclearism. She sits on the territory where there's a radioactive dump from the U.S. government, and she's been working for years to call attention to that and to say stop all nuclear weapons or nuclear waste and whatever brings about that waste. And then there's another group that has come to my attention over since last winter called Nuclear Issues Study Group in New Mexico. and they put on a conference back in December 2017 called Dismantling the Nuclear Beast. And they did so much footwork, to bring grassroots organizers from around Turtle Island and around the world to talk about their work. So that was like a testimonial there at that conference of what people are doing and where they're doing it. So that woman's name is Leona Morgan. She's one of the co-founders of the Nuclear Issues Study Group. And some of the people from New Mexico are here in this area right now for the Grassroots Music Festival. Berta Benali is one of the organizers. Anyway, there's a lot of work going on. It's just under the radar of the corporate media, or intentionally kept below the radar.
It's an honor to be able to speak with Claire, with her. The beauty of her commitment and her faith and her courage is such a major lesson for all of us. I know the Veterans for Peace are so proud of you. A group that I'm a very strong member of, Friends of Franz and Ben, which they have their website as well. The website for Veterans for Peace is simply veteransforpeace.org. And for us, it's bensalmon.org. If you don't know an awful lot about Veterans for Peace or Ben Salmon, you'll be seeing this video through those particular auspices. And we hope that other people will take up on this video and be able to get it around the country, around the world.
Around the world.
Thanks, Claire.
Thank you, Jack. And thanks for bringing up the vets again, because I thought about people sent to war a lot in my incarceration and the trauma of that experience.
Right.
Yeah. Healing for everybody is needed.
You've been listening to Episode 1 of Nonviolent Direct Action, featuring Jack Gilroy of Veterans for Peace interviewing Claire Grady, one of the 7 Kings Bay Plowshares activists who on April 4, 2018, entered Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in St. Mary's, Georgia. Their website is kingsbayplowshares7.org. You can find this program on YouTube, Blogger, SoundCloud, RadioForAll.net, and soon on iTunes, all by searching for our name, Nonviolent Direct Action. Thanks for listening.